Okay, so we're in 1 Kings 18, and still in Elijah. I've been toying around with the idea, by the way, of just doing some back and forth sermons, of like I did before, with having an exegetical sermon from the Bible and then a topical sermon every other week. Remember, we did that for a while. And I want to spend, at least another 4 or 5 weeks more in Elijah. And I've also wanted to do a series or start a series on practical social justice in God's kingdom, and what that means in terms of following Jesus in practical ways as Christians, formatting our lives in such a way to help those who have less than we do, either be it less than we do spiritually or less than we do materially, or just people who need a hand in a tough time. And so I've been thinking about a sermon series about that, but I'm not ready to leave Elijah, so I'm thinking about doing a back and forth sort of thing. So just keep me in your prayers about that, and if you have any input about that or thoughts, send me an email or something, let me know. Okay, so if you'll remember, up to this point in the story, Elijah basically told King Ahab that there was going to be a drought, that the Lord is bringing a drought in the land because of the idolatry in the land, and because of, in particular, the child sacrifice that the Israelites had begun participating in. And so in typical God way, God fashion, Elijah declares a drought and has the power through the Lord to announce that there's going to be a drought throughout the land. There is a drought, and then hightails it as fast as he can out of Jerusalem, because all of the king's men, as it were, are not happy with him and probably want to put him to death. And first he hides out in the Kerith Ravine, where he's fed by the ravens, as we talked about before, and then he goes to the widow's home in Zarephath, which is Canaanite territory, pagan territory, and he stays with her. And her son dies, or becomes in any way incredibly ill, and Elijah revives him. And then the widow finds faith, as it were, puts her trust in Yahweh through Elijah's ministry to her. And that's where we left off. After a long time, in the third year of the drought, so this has been going on, he's been on the run now for years, and the land has been in drought for years. After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab had summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of his palace. Obadiah was a devout believer in the Lord. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and had supplied them with food and water. Ahab had said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs and valleys. Maybe we can find some grass to keep the horses and mules alive, so we will not have to kill any of our animals. So they divided the land they were to cover, Ahab going in one direction and Obadiah in another. Okay, so here we have the movie lens, as it were, shifts to Samaria and to King Ahab and his servant Obadiah, who's probably his highest servant in charge of his palace, a man who Ahab trusts explicitly. And the drought is really hurting them, and so Ahab is concerned about his animals, in particular his horses and mules. Ahab is not a man who's particularly concerned about his people. It never really quite shows up in any of the texts. He is, however, concerned about his animals. As you might guess, the military at that time was very much dependent on having pack animals like mules and horses in order to fight. And so he's concerned about his army. No doubt, at this point, after this much time in drought, Israel's probably a lot sort of similar in some ways to North Korea, in the sense that the army and the things that undergird the power of the dictator are the things that are getting the food and the water, and the people are suffering. And Ahab is concerned because the drought has gotten so bad that even his animals are starting to die. And so he sends Obadiah to look for fresh grass and water, and goes a different way himself looking as well. Of course, that doesn't mean that Obadiah and Ahab are walking alone looking for, they've got their entourage, their people, their army, it's just, that's just the way the Bible talks about it. Okay, so that's the context here. Now, a word about Obadiah, since he plays a role in this story here. He's leading, it's very clear in the text, he's leading a dual life. He's leading sort of an undercover life and sort of his fake life. Ahab trusts him very much. But Obadiah is a follower of Yahweh and is not enamored with Ahab, personally or in terms of his policies. And so for years now, Obadiah has been in a situation where he's in a place of privilege, a place of power, but is working to subvert Ahab's authority, which, as you might imagine, I would guess, would be an incredible place of stress and probably a very unhappy place for a person to be in. And in that capacity, he's even saved some of Yahweh's prophets through the persecution. As Obadiah was walking along, Elijah met him. Obadiah recognized him, bowed down to the ground, and said, "Is it really you, my Lord Elijah?" "Yes," he replied. "Go tell your master, Elijah is here." Now, I want to take this moment to point out, too, that the word of the Lord came to Elijah and said, "Go and present yourself to Ahab." Go, and that's it. Go and present yourself to Ahab. He doesn't say, "Go present yourself to Obadiah." And when Elijah meets Obadiah, he says, "Go tell Ahab to come to me." It's maybe a subtle thing, but I think Elijah's maybe not quite as confident. He's anxious about meeting King Ahab, who wants to kill him, after all, probably in a nasty, brutal way. And so Obadiah, being a fellow follower of the Lord and probably surrounded himself with his retainers and his people, with people who might be of like mind, Elijah is sort of hedging his bets a little bit and saying, "Call Ahab to you. You know, bring him here. There'll be some friendly people here." At least that's how I'm interpreting that. Okay, so Elijah says to Obadiah, "Tell Ahab that I'm here." And Obadiah says, "What have I done wrong that you're handing your servant over to Ahab to be put to death? As surely as the Lord your God lives, there's not a nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to look for you. And whenever a nation or kingdom claimed you were not there, he made them swear they could not find you." It's kind of an Osama bin Laden sort of situation. "But now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah is here. I don't know where the Spirit of the Lord may carry you when I leave you. If I go and tell Ahab and he doesn't find you, he'll kill me. Yet I, your servant, have worshipped the Lord since my youth. Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. And now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah is here. He will kill me." He being King Ahab. So Obadiah has a little rant here. Actually, kind of a significant rant. "Oh, well, that's interesting." Thanks, Ryan. Okay, yeah, can you go to the next slide, actually? Yeah. Thank you. All right. Okay, so Obadiah's angry, and part of his anger seems to be, "I don't know where the Spirit of the Lord's..." You know, Elijah, you called down this drought on this land, and then you just disappear for 3 years. And I've been here in the capital, in the heart of the country, trying to protect the prophets of the Lord, and you've been off gallivanting around God knows where. Well, God does know where, but you get my point. And, you know, and now you want me to go say, "Oh, by the way, Elijah's down there, and if the king comes back and you're not there, then I'm dead." And so he's upset with Elijah. And all Elijah says in return, at the very bottom, if you can read that, he says, "As the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, I will surely present myself to Ahab today." And I think that just serves to remind Obadiah that they're both servants of the Lord, that Elijah's just doing what God has told him to do. He's going to see Ahab today. He's not trying to get out of that divine service, and he will stay there. But he appreciated if Obadiah would bring Ahab to him so he doesn't have to go to where Ahab is. So that's the setup there. And now we get to the most dramatic and, on the surface, the most powerful part of Elijah's story, where he humbles first and then kills the prophets of Baal. I would say it's actually, for Elijah's personal story, not for the story of Israel, but for Elijah's personal story, it's something of a low point. So we're going to look at this now. So this is the context, this is the surrounding narrative here. Okay, next slide. "So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, 'Is that you, troubler of Israel?' 'I have not made trouble for Israel,' Elijah replied, 'but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me in Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table.' So Ahab, thinks this is a pretty good idea. He's outnumbering Elijah. He probably is thinking, well, whatever's going to happen, I can certainly kill Elijah by the time this is all done. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. I think this is, in terms of Yahweh's plan, this is Elijah's job, Elijah's duty, right here and now. And it's part of our duty, all of Christendom, all of us as a kingdom of priests, each of us are ministers of the Lord, to draw, this is a line in the sand moment. This is the in the New Testament you might say the you cannot serve two masters moment. How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. Now, basically what Elijah is saying, that stop hedging your bets. Stop trying to play both sides of this court. You're Hebrews, you're Israelites. Yahweh is your God. And hedging one's bets in a polytheistic society meant trying to appease all the gods. In fact, if two cultures with two different pantheons of gods came together, they would just try and adopt each other's gods and try to appease all the gods so you wouldn't anger any god accidentally. Things obviously have changed. In this society, a policy of appeasement or hedging your bets looks more like, I would say, sort of a gentle theism. I think maybe Jesus is Lord, so it's probably best if I go to church and try to live a relatively good life, more or less, try not to hurt people, try to be a decent sort. Or maybe kind of a gentle agnosticism. I think there's a God. I don't know if we can know much about God, but it seems like there's something there. I'm going to kind of take that in sort of a comforting kind of way, but I'm not going to really spend a lot of time thinking about it or sort of keep it at a distance because those kind of thoughts make me somewhat uncomfortable or somewhat challenging. If the Lord is God, follow him. I do think that this kind of hedging your bets kind of thing, back then in the polytheistic world and now, in my experience, really is the strongest armor against Jesus. Lukewarm behavior and attitudes, to use the word, the lukewarm from the New Testament. From what I've seen, and maybe you've had a different experience, but the most strident atheists are often closer to God sometimes than sort of a complacent Christian or a moderate agnostic or whatever you want to say. And I think that's because, if you meet someone who's really militantly atheistic, they're zealous, they're passionate about truth and passionate about belief and about things being either right or wrong, that there is truth in the world and that we can find it, and knowing the difference between what's true and what's false and what's right and what's wrong. Be that as it may, and that's just my opinion, one thing's for sure, Yahweh, to follow Yahweh, doesn't leave any room for hedging our bets. It really is an all-or-nothing sort of thing. That doesn't mean all-or-nothing in the sense of living perfectly, like I'm going to live a perfect life and be holy and wise and all these things. It just means where your heart is, what you've given yourself over to completely. So whether it's here from Elijah's mouth or from Jesus telling us we can't serve two masters and that those who lose their lives will find them, there's really no space. And I'm saying this as a reminder to me, as much to anybody, there's no space for giving 25% of your heart to God and reserving the rest for your own agenda. There just isn't. There's no room for that. That will lead to disappointment, sadness, or probably the worst thing of all, boredom. Which I find to be the most, when I see people whose lives are boring them. I mean, this is life, right? I mean, this is, the sun comes up in the morning and goes down at night, and there's the beauty of creation and our families and our friends and our loved ones, and you're bored, really? But I think that comes from a lukewarm behavior and a lukewarm attitude. Anyway, so maybe I'm making, well, no, I don't think I'm making too much of it. I think this really is, This is the point for Elijah, that you can't do both. And you can't have this sort of licentious, do whatever you want, you know, do whatever feels good. Pick your God, pick your favorite nature deity, and just make that your life, and follow Yahweh and go to temple and say that you're okay. You really have to make a choice. And he draws that line in the sand. And at this point, I think Elijah's very excited because he knows that God's going to do something powerful and amazing. And the people say nothing. Well, we can grant them some grace there. Ahab's soldiers are probably all around with pikes and, you know, nothing might be what you'd say too at that point. Well, let's see what's going to happen. What is going to happen? Can you give me the next slide there, Dominique?
Yep.
Thanks. Then Elijah said to them, "I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left." Not entirely true, a little bit of hyperbole, but we'll let that pass. "I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call in the name of your God, and I will call in the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people say, "What you say is good." Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there's so many of you. 450 prophets, you can prepare a bull like that, or so I'm told. Call the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So they took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. "Baal, answer us," they shouted, but there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, he gave them some time. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he's sleeping, must be awakened." So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response, no one answered, no one paid attention. I think actually that last line, "no one paid attention," at that point it's probably referring to all the people gathered around who are probably bored stiff by this endless prophesying. Okay, let's go to the next one. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. And this is Elijah's moment of victory. For him, I think this was the high point of his entire life and ministry. Now, all of Israel gathered around the prophets of Baal. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." And keep in mind that this time Israel's divided, Samaria in the north and Judah in the south. It's a divided kingdom, never mind the paganism and polytheism. And Elijah is saying, you're supposed to be one people. You're supposed to be one people in God. With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold two seahs of seed, basically just a shallow trench all around it. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. And he said to them, "Fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood." "Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it the third time. And the water went down around the altar and filled the trench. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." And there's the difference between Yahweh and the pagan gods, that the pagan priests are trying to coerce or convince their gods to do something for them, slashing themselves, cutting themselves, trying to get the proper response from their god. But all this is at Yahweh's behest. This isn't Elijah doing it. It's Yahweh from the beginning. "Let it be known today that you are God and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me." Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stone, and the soil, and licked up the water in the trench. And that is the climactic moment for Elijah. That is his moment of tremendous victory. And then something very strange happens. If we can get the next slide. Thanks, Dominique. All the people saw it, and they fall down, and they say, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God." Then Elijah commanded them, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away. And they seized them. And Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. And Elijah said to Ahab, now, if you know something, there's been an abrupt shift. Have you noticed it? What is it?
Elijah's in charge.
Elijah's in charge. All of a sudden, he's got the power. And not only that, but in the just the previous paragraph, everything was at the behest of the Lord. Everything was at the command of the Lord. Go present yourself to Ahab. There's going to be a famine in the land. Go do this. Go do that. Suddenly, who's calling the shots? It's Elijah, right? He's even telling Ahab what to do. In fact, it's a bit of micromanaging. So Elijah said to Ahab, go eat and drink. Go party. For there's the sound of a heavy rain. He's confident this is going to happen. There's going to be a heavy, you know, he can hear it already. He can hear the rain. Go party. The drought's over. I can hear the rain. So Ahab went off to eat and drink. But Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees. Now that's weird. Isn't that a little odd? At his moment of triumph, he climbs up to the top of the mountain, right next to the sea. Mount Carmel's right next to the Mediterranean Sea. And he puts his face between his knees. Doesn't even say he's praying. Just says he won't look up. He's at the top of the mountain. In order to see the ocean, all he has to do is look up. But he just puts his face down between his knees. He tells his servant, go and look toward the sea. And he went and looked. There's nothing there, he said. 7 times Elijah said, go back. And the 7th time the servant reported, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. And Elijah says, and this is weird too. Elijah says, go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. They're on top of a mountain, remember? So it means go down. Don't get caught in the rain. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel, where Jezebel is. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. And that's the end of the chapter. It's a very strange thing that occurs here. And I think the story of Elijah is 2 stories. One is the story of Israel, where Elijah draws that line in the sand. He says, you need to choose. That you need to pick Yahweh or these pagan gods. But something switched here, and something happened, and it will come clear in the next chapter, which we'll talk about next week. But one of the things that happened was Elijah, well, in a sense, he had sort of a Judas moment, where he thought he knew what God was doing. He thought he knew the plan. He thought that this was the moment when Yahweh was going to come, reclaim Israel, all the 12 tribes would come back together again, all the Baals would be pushed out, polytheism would be dead in the land, and he would be, you know, in charge as Yahweh's prophet. And it doesn't quite happen that way. And we're not told, ever, not in this chapter, not in the following, what the people are saying or doing at this point, the general populace. It says that they, at his command, they seized the prophets of Baal and killed them, which isn't terribly surprising considering what they just saw happen at the altar. They're probably terrified of Elijah. But something changes, yes?
How do we know that those prophets wouldn't have been converted by what they saw?
Well, yeah, the thing about, one of the fun things about the Old Testament is that there's no backstory.
It's too late.
What?
You're just saying like it's too late?
I don't know.
Because of your history? Or...
I mean, it may have been, I want to be careful with this because it may have been God's will on some level for them to be killed like that. That's possible. I'm not, you know, I don't really know one way or the other. But the tone of the story switches very abruptly at this point, and it seems like there's a shift from God's initiative and God doing things to Elijah taking initiative, and then at the very end, there's some ambiguity or some even fear or possibly repentance coming from Elijah. And it gets more powerful in the next chapter. So I my tendency is to think that Elijah took the reins of power and thought this was the Lord coming and making, as it were, heaven on earth again in Israel. But the fact of the matter is that the people really weren't, that only a minority of people, only a remnant, I think, of people really gave their hearts to Yahweh that day. I don't think it was the repentance, the excitement that he was looking for. I think there was fear, and I think there was, butchery, certainly, but I don't think it looked like what he was looking for. And as I said, it comes even clearer in the next chapter, but that'll take us too long. So the two stories I think that are encapsulating Elijah's story, Elijah does push back against the prophets of Baal, and there are people in Israel who come to the Lord through Elijah's ministry and through his power, through Yahweh. But there's a second story, which is Elijah's personal story. And I think that's the arc of a life given to the Lord. And I wrote it down here, so I'd make sure I say what I meant to say. I think the proper arc, I don't know if I'm using this term correctly, but of a follower of the Lord, passionate fervor in his youth. I mean, we've all seen that. You know, he was on fire for Yahweh. Chastised in his middle age. I'm going through that now. But he comes up against his own limitations and comes up against his own fears and doubts in relation to Yahweh. And then gracefully mentored his replacement. That's Elisha. We'll come S-H-A, Elisha. We'll talk about him later. And then retires. Except in his case, in a pretty dramatic way. But I think what we're hitting here is Elijah's midpoint, if you will, his midlife crisis, where he really thought he knew what God was doing, and he realized, oh, this is something completely different than what I even imagined. This isn't the ultimate restoration of Israel through my ministry. This is something different. And that's a sobering thing for him. I think we'll end there. Does anybody have any questions?
I'm just thinking, you know, the image of a man sitting on the ground, putting his head between his knees, conveys to me somebody who's in great doubt, or maybe even shameful, or confused, or just lost, or something.
Yeah.
And that happened right after the slaughter.
Yeah.
So maybe he had, after he did that, he was overwhelmed with, have I done the right thing?
Yeah. Well, I think he... I'm not exactly sure what it is because the story is so strangely written, but something went awry there. I mean, just the fact that he tells Ahab that he can hear heavy rain coming, and Ahab goes off to party, and then there's this confusion. Well, wait a minute, where's the rain? What's going on? I mean, what happened here? So it might have been the slaughter of the prophets. I don't really know. Or it could have been the response of the people. There's all kinds of things. Or maybe Elijah was just depressed by his own sudden imperiousness, commanding people to do, not listening for the word of the Lord.
It could be that he prayed.
It could be that he prayed, too. That's true.
Just reading James, it says right. Elijah began just of the same nature as we were, that he prayed that the heavens would withhold the rain. And
right.
Then he prayed again and it rained. It could be that God was testing him to see, you know, how long are you willing to pray that this actually takes place.
That's possible, yeah. But it is strange wording for usually when the Old Testament says, usually he just says they prayed, he bowed his head and prayed or did whatever, and this is just kind of different. And then the next passage, I think, maybe both are true, actually, just come to think of it, because something definitely goes awry with Elijah. But at any rate, he probably is praying. Speaking of which, let's pray. Lord, I just ask that even when we run up against our own limitations and our own faults and the things that undermine us, Lord, that even in our sin and our brokenness, I know that we can still give 100% of our heart and our soul to you. And so, Lord, I pray that for each of us here tonight, that we would even now rededicate our lives to following you. I thank you, Lord, that you are a God of grace, of forgiveness, of purity, of peace. Lord, I thank you that you give us stability in our lives, but also excitement and adventure. Lord, I just pray that we would walk gladly with you, with great joy, even in times of trial. And Lord, I pray that you would meet us at your table now, reminding us of where joy and sorrow meet. in your crucifixion and the resurrection and the forgiveness of sins. Lord, pray that you would meet us there. Amen.